our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone Chapter 16, Through the Trap Door. Goodness me, does a lot happen in this chapter, Ben.
Yes, it sure does. I mean, this is probably the biggest. I mean, it's the second longest chapter of the book.
Yeah.
Second only to Diagon Alley, which is chapter 5.
Okay. I mean, a lot happens there, too.
A lot happens there, too. And to be fair, I mean, chapter 17, the grand conclusion to Sorcerer's Stone, Philosopher's Stone, also rather vital chapter. It's one of those where it's amazing where it starts and where it ends.
I know. Like, the amount of stuff that happens in the next chapter as well is crazy. But like, yeah, in this one, it feels like in my brain, it feels like each task could almost be its own chapter. But sometimes, like, because they go through all the tasks and all the tasks are so iconic.
They are, yeah.
Sometimes they're like half a page long or something.
I know. It's wild. And the thing I kept thinking about the whole time was I was like, man, honestly, the obstacles for the Philosopher's Stone would have made for an absolutely spectacular, like final task for the Triwizard Tournament.
Oh, right.
You know, I mean, it's like you have to go and test all your different abilities.
Yeah. And I mean, in so many ways, like the maze is just very much like this exact task, or the getting through the stone.
Yeah,
it's
like it
breaking
really is
through a series of obstacles, except when Harry does it in the maze, he is not able to like call upon Ron and Hermione.
Yes, as well. Yeah, for sure. Where you definitely start to see the fact that you've got multiple different skill sets all at play, kind of contributing to the overall prowess of the Golden Trio as a collective. So
I think going through it the way that we're doing it now, I think something that really stood out a lot more was like they each have their moments for sure. Like everyone contributes, and they couldn't have done it without each other. But like the number of times like Harry is the one who is like I was writing down like every time we went through something, I was like, ooh, that's a point for Harry, or that's a point for Ron, or whatever. And it's like Harry comes out on top and it's not close.
Oh, that, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I like that though, because I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, Harry is supposed to be sort of like, you know, the central lead main character or whatever.
For sure. It's his name on the front of the book here.
It is. There are so many times where I'm like, you know, sometimes I'm almost like, gosh, you know, Hermione almost is like a little bit like cheated for not having her name. Like, at least on the cover.
Oh, you know, I know. Like, yeah. Like, and I mean, especially going forward. But right, in this particular set of obstacles, Harry does really shine.
There you go.
I will say, though, before we start, Ben, one, I was looking through the charts as I'm prone to do.
Okay.
At these times, I was trying to see, you know, where we were with our beloved Guyana listeners.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are constantly thrusting us to the top. Right. And I would say that right now we've fallen a little. I think we're number six in Guyana right now. However, man, we are presently number one in both Argentina and Panama in entertainment news podcasts.
How about it?
So booyah.
How about it?
Argentina's pretty big. I mean,
I'll take it.
I will take it.
There we go.
What's up, Argentina?
Well How's done with Lionel Messi over there, you know?
Well, yeah, just, you know, crushing it.
Excellent inclusion for planet Earth.
Yeah.
okay, so yeah, so let's go ahead and dive on into chapter 16, Through the Trap Door. We do have our chapter art here, which is a lovely illustration of old Fluffy.
Dude, I love this chapter art. I love how absolutely derpy Fluffy looks. It is so fantastic.
You know, Fluffy is kind of like one of those interesting creations where it's like, there's a part of me that's almost like, if you were just to imagine like a small dog, not even a small dog, but like a Labrador with three heads. I mean, it would be pretty intimidating no matter what.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, you have to assume that Fluffy is about, what would you approximate Fluffy is the size of?
I mean, I think it says like floor to ceiling. So,
okay. Like an elephant?
I'm thinking like, yeah, like an elephant, I guess.
I thought you were going to say bigger than an elephant.
Like maybe, like when I'm thinking like in the first movie, I feel like Fluffy looks bigger than an elephant. Maybe about like body height wise about the same, but then like an elephant's head kind of like comes directly out of the front of its very horizontal body and then just droops down.
Sure.
Whereas Fluffy's like raises up and then has two more, all of which are huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Fluffy does seem really dangerous, but there is something like really rewarding to me though, that out of all of the various professors, Hagrid's obstacle is the one that was the hardest to overcome.
I know there is something very nice about that. Although really, really the trick of course to getting around Fluffy is getting through Hagrid, which is, I guess Voldemort's able to take advantage of that pretty easily, which it's so unfortunate for Hagrid that it's like, it's so funny to me that Voldemort is the one who like tricks Hagrid into revealing the information when it was also Voldemort who like framed him for murder.
Tom Riddle's relationship with Rubeus Hagrid is certainly one where poor Hagrid is always on the negative end of that.
Oh, I know.
Of that feud.
He's like, Tom Riddle is like, I can count on Hagrid having a large beast that I can, wheedle some information out of. I can rely on him having a large beast being the way I get something done.
Yes, yes. Well, in the kind of like the really big and interesting question is, I mean, I would say chapter 16 above all else is the one that emphasizes Dumbledore's big plan in its finest form.
Yeah.
And like, so the general premise of Dumbledore's big plan, I know we've touched on it a couple of times, but really we're kind of here and now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it feels like the time to discuss it. But the basic idea is that Dumbledore knows of the prophecy. And with that information at hand and Harry's arrival at school, he's fairly certain that Voldemort's attempted return is imminent. We're inside of like the end game now. Like now is when Dumbledore, more than ever, is going to have to really start to train and direct Harry on everything that he is going to need to do in order to topple the Dark Lord eventually.
Right.
And we actually just did an entire video breakdown, actually because of the Forbidden Forest chapter that we just did last week.
Yeah.
Where we were talking about astronomy and the ways in which, like, at least within the wizarding world, it seems like the actual movement, like the future, is quite literally imprinted in the stars.
Right. Like the wizards aren't very good at reading it themselves. Yes. But the centaurs clearly are very good at reading it.
Yes.
Like, and like, this is information they like closely guard in the same way that like goblins guard how to make like, you know, goblin made armor.
Right.
Or like, you know, the sword of Gryffindor that can absorb all the things that make it stronger. Like wizards don't know how to do it.
Exactly. But there's a couple of other exceptions that I think, like, so what I was going to allude to though, is then when we first see Dumbledore in this very book, he pulls out a rather extraordinary pocket watch.
Yeah.
That instead of having your typical hands of a clock, instead has complex movements of what appear to be 12 different planets.
It says 12 hands and had little planets orbiting around the edge.
Okay. So the general idea here here is that possibly if anybody within the wizarding world is capable of overcoming the challenge and seeing the world in the way that is most similar to the centaurs, then it's probably Dumbledore. And I think you could do that. You can back that claim up with the fact that Dumbledore, for one, does seem to be the only one who always knows what's going on. Yeah. He specifically, even if he doesn't know exactly how like Voldemort has infiltrated, it seems like he tasks Snape with watching over Quirrell.
Right.
So I think we can maybe assume on some level that Dumbledore knows that Quirrell is the one to look out for, but maybe not the way in which Voldemort has like resided in the back of his head.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It's like hard to know how much he knows, but you're right. There is that scene where he tells Snape, like, keep an eye on Quirrell, will you? And it's like, why does Dumbledore specifically suddenly suspect Quirrell? But at the same time, like, the amount of information to be gleaned from the stars and the planet's movements is, like, fairly specific.
It is.
Like, when Harry is talking to Ferenc, he said, you know, Ferenc just straight up says, do you know what is hidden in the school at this very moment, Mr. Potter? And it's like, what he's talking about is the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yes.
And it's like, the Sorcerer's Stone, like, no one should know where it is at all.
Right.
Like, the general wizarding, as far as they're concerned, like, maybe it's with Nicholas Flamel. It's secretly at Gringotts, and then it is secretly moved from Gringotts to Hogwarts.
Right.
So it is like, nobody should know where it is, least of all the centaurs who just live in the forest. And yet, just by looking at the stars, they know where the Sorcerer's Stone is hidden, like, not maybe specifically in the school, but like that the stone itself, the stone is hidden at Hogwarts. Like, that information is available to them by looking at the sky, which is crazy to me.
It is, yeah.
But Dumbledore has that pocket watch that basically looks like, you know, some kind of, the planets are moving and there's 12 hands on it. And it's like, it doesn't really make sense to have a pocket watch that doesn't just tell time traditionally, because like, there's no reason to overcomplicate this particular thing.
Right, like time is a fairly simple, like, you know, yes, aspect of reality.
So, right, yes. Which ironically is also dictated by the movement
of
stars and Earth.
Yeah, yeah,
right, of Earth, yeah, around the sun anyway. Right, the way, yeah, we keep track of time.
Right.
Yeah, so there is that, but it's like, why not just have a regular pocket watch? It's like, to me, because he pulls it out and says, Hagrid's late, which to me, it's like, it's as if he's read the time, but it's like, according to the future, Hagrid should be here, but he's not. He's late or something.
Right.
Like, no, the time it's telling isn't the present time. It is time that hasn't happened yet.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah, yeah. And I think on this exact same note, you know, like what you fast forward to is the other thing that the centaurs are being able to see. And you pointed this out to me in last week's episode, and I sort of had like a mind blown moment a little bit, but it's the, it's basically the concept that while they're out in the Forbidden Forest for detention, as far as the centaurs are concerned, who have interpreted the stars, you know, they are aware of the fact that at some point in time, in order for the war to end, certain events need to unfold. And those events include Voldemort's destruction of one Harry Potter. And it's like, in this moment, in the forest, what they are witnessing is all of the puzzle pieces essentially coming together,
right,
you know, in order for this event to take place.
Yeah, like, and Harry's here, Voldemort's here, we know this has to happen. Okay, it's happening.
Right, exactly. But the big thing that we learn is that, like, you know, their interpretation, this is by Ferenc's own like a mission when he's teaching later, is that like even centaurs can have it wrong. Like, you know, like stars are so big and like their message is so grand,
right,
that like they only tell of the massive pieces. Like, you know, they're not focused on ants and their movement or whatever the case,
right,
may be.
Like, so the fact that they happen to be off by 6 years is like,
it's a rounding error.
It's a rounding error. It's like instead of, you know, instead of hitting the bullseye dead center, they've hit the bullseye, but like a little to the left.
Precisely.
You know?
Yeah. But so my point is, especially as we circle back to Dumbledore here, is that we also know that Dumbledore is uniquely capable of understanding Parselmouth,
yep,
which we see in his memory of the trip to the Gaunt Shack in Half-Blood Prince.
Yep.
We know that Dumbledore is uniquely capable of speaking Mirmish, you know, with the mermaids. And so I think that like him having this like centaur level of comprehension of what is going on inside of the stars as well, you know, and it brings you back to all of like the silver instruments that you see inside of Dumbledore's office for years and years and years to come. And it's like, it is entirely possible that all of these like little instruments are basically like helping him to understand the massive,
oh, yeah,
like position changes of the players on the board.
He's good at like reading unusual kinds of magic. Even in the cave when he's like breaking it down and like putting blood on it and just touching stuff. It's like that's not the way Harry's ever seen wizards work anything out before.
Yes.
But like Dumbledore's good at it. And to that point, it's like the centaurs even come to Dumbledore's funeral and do like some big like salute with the bow and arrows.
Yes, they
like,
sure do.
So, yeah. Which almost suggests, like, clearly they are familiar with Dumbledore enough to come give a salute.
Right.
So it's like, that suggests that maybe Dumbledore has spent time with them and, like, learned
meaningful
from
time.
Yeah, meaningful time with them. Because, like, he even goes in and hires Ferenz. It's not like, you know, I doubt that was the first time he'd met him.
Oh, certainly not. Yeah, although that does land Ferenz with a permanent banishment from his colony as
it
a
does.
Result. So, yeah. I mean, it's not well received. But ultimately we do know, and again, this is what you kind of discussed last week, but then the centaurs are unwilling to involve themselves inside of the fight against Voldemort until what is written in the stars has come to pass, which we of course know is Voldemort's killing of Harry, which does ultimately happen in the Forbidden Forest. And then after that attack, the centaurs do then join the battle and kind of help turn the tide. But all of this to say basically is that like what our big belief for this story is that all throughout year one, and a lot of what you're going to see in this chapter is that there are challenges that are capable of being completed. That like even Hagrid being so well trusted by Dumbledore, like one interpretation of that isn't necessarily like I would trust him to keep a secret. It might be I trust Hagrid to reveal the information that I need him to reveal to Harry at the right times, because I know the ways in which like Hagrid's not infallible. I know how he is fallible.
Right. Because the other thing at the end of the day is that there are all these obstacles in the way, but like there doesn't need to be any protections at all because the mirror is not beatable.
The mirror is not beatable, but then even as you go through each of the individual challenges themselves, there's also the argument that could easily be made for like, why put the winged keys in the room that has the door that needs to be unlocked? Why put brooms in there at all? You could just enter them into a room that has a locked door that can't be opened
through
traditional magic.
And right, there's a part where like you have to jump through the trap door and you don't know what's at the bottom. It's just like, hey, guess what? If you put nothing at the bottom, that's going to stop everybody.
Yes, because you will just fall and land on concrete.
Exactly. Like,
or rocks.
You're just going to fall and crash to the ground and that'll be that.
Exactly. So the big thing that we've always kind of subscribed to, or for years now, is this basic idea that Dumbledore has been very carefully watching Harry throughout the year. He's very carefully like kind of preparing him from afar at this point, where he's taking into consideration the fact that Ron is good at chess. He's taking into consideration the fact that Hermione is good at logic, that Harry is good on a broomstick. You know, that like maybe the trio of them could potentially work together to overcome certain things. The fact that he is given the invisibility cloak for Christmas alongside the flute, which will ultimately be used to lull Fluffy to sleep. You know, even that feels like no mistake.
Right. There's a lot of things in here. And there is one big thing in here that I know we're already like sort of subscribed to this here, that Dumbledore is like training Harry or using this to like train Harry or test how good he is.
Right.
Or whatever. But like there was another little thing that I picked up on this particular read through that I was like, ah. So we'll get to that when we get to it.
Okay.
But
without any further ado,
we're going to start talking about the chapter.
Yeah, we've clambered on for a little while here. So let's go ahead and start. Where we're picking up is we've made it to exam time, and kind of hilariously it reminded me of the line I brought up in the chapter about taking Norbert to the astronomy tower.
Yeah.
Where it's just basically like a line that just says like Harry and Hermione would never remember how they even did it. Like how they ever got Norbert to the top of the tower. It's almost one of those things where it's like everybody could recognize when writing the story that it would be too complicated and it would be an entire chapter on its own to watch them try to move a crate containing a dragon from the front door.
Right.
All the way up to the tallest
tower
without encountering Filch or Mrs. Norris or any other teachers patrolling or ghosts or anyone at all. So it's just one of those like blanket statements where it's sort of like somehow they got there,
right.
You know, and that's
right.
It.
And they took the exams.
And they took the exams because that's exactly how this chapter starts, with one of these sentences where it just says, Harry would never quite remember how he had managed to get through his exams when he half expected Voldemort to come bursting through the door at any moment. This is just like a one sentence way of saying like, I could have given you a whole chapter about Harry taking exams and all the various things that he went through. I'm going to give you like three paragraphs.
Right.
And that's pretty much going to sum up everything he went through.
I do think it is funny that for Snape's exam, they have to remember all of the ingredients for how to make a forgetfulness potion. And it's just like, hell, they tried to remember how to make a forgetfulness potion. It was like, I get it. It's like doing it right, making it hard to do it right.
I know. Yeah. It's like, are the fumes that you're producing in your forgetfulness potion actively working against you? And the real challenge is like, what kind of mental fortitude do you have in order to like persevere through this?
Indeed.
I also thought it was kind of funny that McGonagall gives points on their task of turning a mouse into a snuff box, and it says points were given for how pretty the snuff box was. And I just wrote down, oddly subjective for Minerva.
I know.
Like it's sort of like is it taking like Minerva's own like personal preferences into style? Like what does she look for?
It's like that's a bit minimalistic, Weasley.
You know? Exactly. Yeah. Or too ornate, long bottom. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Devil had whiskers. You kidding?
Oh yeah, 100%. Let's see here.
I think one of the things they mentioned history of magic, and it just mentions one answering questions about baddie old wizards who'd invented self-stirring cauldrons and they'd be free. And it was the history of magic is such an annoying class to me in the story, because like it should be a pretty interesting class.
It absolutely should.
But it's like always so boring. And it's like, what? How relevant can it be to know who'd invented self-stirring cauldrons when the students in the present don't even use them?
Oh, I know. You know? I literally wrote down, this hardly feels like a historically relevant invention.
Oh, I know. I was like, you know what? I was like, why would you teach this? And I was like, now you know what? We learned about like the cotton gin and stuff like that. And I'm like,
that changed. Yeah. Like civilization.
I know. And I'm like, yeah, and you know what? They still make cotton shirts.
Right, yes. To this day, turns out it was a very useful thing to have created.
Yeah. It's like, you know what? They don't use self-stirring cauldrons, even in potions class, where stirring is like a big deal.
This would be much more like if it was common knowledge for us non-magical folk to be like, yes, the inventor of the cheese grater.
Right.
It's like, it's not like I'm here to say that a cheese grater isn't a useful invention. It's just not relevant.
Yeah. And it's not like who invented wands or something.
Precisely. You know? But no, I love your point too, because history of magic is one of those things where it's like we could almost even, if we were never permitted the opportunity to like write a founder series, like even just titling something The History of Magic and going through and witnessing like the ways in which different spells were invented in the first place, or like, you know, because I think what one of the things that would be so interesting about watching the founders would be watching them discover stuff, because you learn as time goes on that like a lot of the stuff that happens in magic doesn't happen for centuries after the founders themselves.
Right.
So like, you know, there's tons of magic that they just simply never got to see ever.
I know, yeah,
you
know, right?
Like it'd be like mind-blowing, I'm sure, to be like, you know, and these are some of the greatest witches and wizards to have ever lived like a full millennium after they had existed, and they didn't know about self-stirring cauldrons.
They didn't know about self-stirring cauldrons. They were stirring them themselves like a bunch of chumps.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have known about like, you know, Sectum Sempra or like Levit Corpus or
Sleek Easy's hair potion.
Hair potion. They wouldn't have they wouldn't have the Wolfsbane potion.
Right. Yep. All these things were invented way after.
Actually, speaking of werewolves, they'd also talk about, or Hermione says she needn't have learned about the 1637 werewolf code of conduct or the uprising of Elfric the Eager. So obviously I went ahead and learned about those myself.
Oh yeah, naturally, of course. Yeah. Is Elfric a goblin?
Yes, Elfric is a goblin, despite having elf in his name.
It's like one of those things where it's like, I feel like goblin rebellions is like 87% of what they learn about.
Yeah, it's like, even though Harry happens to be alive during a time of wizard war, it seems like most of history is full of like wizard versus goblin war.
It does seem that way.
Yeah. But yeah, Elfric the Eager, not much is known about him other than that he's apparently a goblin based solely, which is information that is based on an image of him appearing on the cover of a book in the app Hogwarts Mystery. Which, man, let me tell you guys, massive pet peeve of mine, because we have to do a lot of like research on Harry Potter stuff for our job, as you might expect.
We
get to do it, and it is so frustrating when I'll be reading on like Wikipedia and they'll be like, how did I miss this? When was this information revealed? Is this like some like cool new thing? And it's like, oh, it's Hogwarts Mystery. Mm-hmm. Oh, this character revealed some interesting factoid about this, but it was in Hogwarts Mystery. I'm like, I don't know if I count that.
I don't think I can count it. Yeah, Jacob's sibling comes up all the time.
I know. It feels like there's too many decisions to be made by the player that could affect it. So like something like this, I'm fine with. It's like Elfric the Eager. Oh, we confirmed he's a goblin. It's like there's no higher level canon to dispute it. So like, I guess it's fine and it doesn't hurt anything. So there you go. Elfric the Eager is a goblin based on Hogwarts Mystery. The 1637 Werewolf Code of Conduct was developed was a set of rules outlining the responsibilities of werewolves, such as preventing any possible attacks by locking themselves up securely every month. So the problem was that it was a really ineffective code of conduct because no one showed up to sign it since no one was prepared to admit to being a werewolf due to the great stigma amongst the wizarding society, which I thought was like kind of like a funny thing.
No, that is very interesting. And it also was kind of fascinating what the procedure was specifically, because that's pretty much what the Shrieking Shack is eventually built for Lupin anyway, is a safe place for him to go.
Yeah, just to transform and not hurt anybody.
Precisely.
But while I was looking that up, I also came across another fun fact about werewolves that answers a question we were having about werewolf cubs other day.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So here we go. One curious feature of the condition is that if two werewolves meet and mate at the full moon, a highly unlikely contingency, which is known to have only occurred twice, the result of the mating will be wolf cubs, which resemble true wolves in everything except their abnormally high intelligence. They are not more aggressive than normal wolves and do not single out humans for attack. Such a litter was once set free under conditions of extreme secrecy in the Forbidden Forest at Hogwarts with the kind permission of Albus Dumbledore. The cubs grew into beautiful and unusually intelligent wolves, and some of them live there still, which has given rise to the stories about werewolves in the forest. Stories that none of the teachers or the gamekeeper has done much to dispel, because keeping students out of the forest is, in their view, highly desirable.
Wow.
So there you go. That is why people say there are werewolves in the forest, is because there are wolves that are the product of two werewolves mating during the full moon that are basically just hyper-intelligent wolves, but they are not people that transform into werewolves.
That is super fascinating, especially because I think that it's Tom Riddle in the diary that claims that Hagrid once was raising werewolf cubs under his bed.
Right. So this is probably that lot.
It's probably that lot, which is always one of those things that always felt like hyperbole to me. It was Hagrid would, you know, high five the giant squid if he could or something like that, you know, which actually hilariously.
Yeah, there is some.
Are hanging out with the giant squid this very page. But like it almost to me feels like such a reach. Like obviously that's not really true. But if it's Albus Dumbledore, then it kind of could make sense because we, the very least, would have known that he would be a teacher at Hogwarts while Hagrid was a student. So maybe that is how he could have permitted those cubs to go.
That makes sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me is how Hagrid would have gotten his hands on these cubs to begin with.
It does seem highly unlikely.
I know. Yeah. Like you were there for them, for the wolf giving birth, for, I guess, woman in human form. This is the other tricky thing is that
I suppose it could be the case that the wolf cubs would not be where they might be according to nature if they're, I don't even know how to describe what I'm trying to say.
I don't know how this would work. Yeah, like how long would it take for the pregnancy to last, and could they be delivered while the person was a human, or would they have to be delivered while they were a werewolf? And then, like, I suppose if that happened, then the werewolf mother could just sort of be like, you know, out of their mind and be like, okay, I gave birth, see ya, and just abandon the cubs, and that's when Hagrid steps in to collect. That's what I'm thinking is going to have had to have happened.
Yeah, we're writing a backstory based on such peripheral information.
This is that almost has to be how it works. But we talked about this for a while in an earlier episode, and I found the answer, and I was like, oh my gosh, okay. So
got it. No, I love it. Okay,
that's not on Hogwarts Mystery. That's just like Pottermore archives. That's real writing.
That's
so
real writing. Okay, we'll take it. Okay, so as we move forward, though, we once again find Harry, Ron, and Hermione flopping under potentially the beech tree next to
the beech tree.
The Black Lake?
Yeah.
Where the Weasley twins and Lee Jordan are tickling the tentacles of the giant squid. It is entirely possible this is the exact same tree that we will eventually see inside of Snape's memory, where he is being tormented by the marauders.
Yep.
It's the beech tree I'm always talking about. So I've started to notice that one kind of showing up left, right, and center. Let's see. The next page... we get like a little bit of a line that I always think is kind of interesting, but it's Ron saying, we've got a week before we find out how badly we've done. There's no need to worry yet. This is kind of interesting to me because it sort of suggests that like at the end of the school year, there's quite literally just like a week that the students just spend at the castle.
Just at the castle. I know. I was like, that's probably the best week of the year.
Dude, I bet. I was like literally like while I was reading it, because like, you know, as a kid who didn't like love going to school necessarily, like there's a part of me that would almost be like, dude, exam's over. Like I am ready to go home.
Exactly.
But I could totally see how it'd be like, it'd be so fun to have that scarce time at the end of the year where it's sort of like, man, we're not about to see each other for a long time. Like, you just want to spend time with your friends. It's like, it's sunny, it's warm. You don't have any like the other responsibilities. Like, all your food is still tended to and taken care of. Like, it honestly sounds sort of amazing.
It does. So. Yeah, that sounds really fun. So that sounds fantastic. Then Harry's scar keeps hurting though, so he's not totally able to enjoy it. He says, I think it's a warning. It means danger's coming. And I read that and I'm like, is that right? It's not normally how the scar works. It's normally just like Voldemort's feeling an emotion. And that's what, so I guess maybe it's sort of right, but
yeah, I think so. I mean, it's like, I think probably what you could be anticipating here is, I mean, it is on this exact same evening that Voldemort/Quirrell are attempting to secure the stone.
That's
so
true.
If you're Voldemort, like, I mean, I don't think it's a warning necessarily. I just think that what's happening here is that like it's burning because Voldemort's like, tonight's the night, man. Like, I'm coming back.
Tonight's the night.
Like, he thinks this is the graveyard of Little Hangleton, in my mind, right? Like, I mean, that's where we're at.
I guess so. I guess you're right. Yeah, like maybe he's like feeling particularly anxious.
Right.
So that makes sense. There's also a line that's where it says, and Neville will play Quidditch for England before Hagrid lets Dumbledore down. And I'm like, well, then sign Neville up for England, because like one paragraph later, guess what's going to happen?
No, but once again, though, it's like, does Hagrid let Dumbledore down, or does Hagrid do exactly what Dumbledore expected Hagrid to do?
Well, I get... which is to let him down.
Which is the, well, I mean, he's, but yeah, I guess so. I guess so. If you want to look at it that way.
Yeah. Okay. But so, yeah. So Hagrid, in fact, does let him slip. Okay. This is the thing that really, I think, sells me on the Dumbledore's big plan, the thing I discovered in this particular read through that I think sells me on Dumbledore's big plan even more than I was already sold, which is pretty big.
Okay.
It is when Harry realizes how Hagrid got the dragon's egg. And he says, you know, don't you think it's a bit odd that the... That's what Hagrid wants more than anything else is a dragon, and a stranger turns up who just happens to have an egg in his pocket? So what is interesting here is that it means that... Because he's realizing that Hagrid traded the information about Fluffy to get the dragon's egg, right?
Yes.
Which means that Quirrell's actually had the information about how to get past Fluffy for quite some time.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why hasn't he acted until now?
Oh, it's a good point. You know? You have to wait for Dumbledore to leave.
Because you have to wait for Dumbledore to leave.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Like, and you say like, oh, we got to wait for Dumbledore to leave. But the problem is Quirrell is still the one who sends him the fake note about leaving. So it's not like he was just waiting for the opportunity for Dumbledore to be gone. Like, he's still the one who sets it in motion. So why does he wait till tonight to set it in motion?
Do you have an answer to that question?
I think he's tried many times to get Dumbledore to leave. And the reason Dumbledore leaves is because he knows that Hagrid, that he knows Harry has figured out.
Oh, I got
that
you.
That Hagrid gave up the information. He's like, okay, Harry has the final piece of the puzzle. Harry has figured out how to get past Fluffy. I'm out of here.
Yeah, because I mean, and I think that what we discover is that Dumbledore quite literally, I think McGonagall says it, like left the castle 10 minutes ago or something like
that.
Yeah,
it's like the moment Dumbledore knows that like Hagrid has let slip to Harry too. He's like, I'm out.
No, you're so right. Yeah. I mean, it's all happening within like the same 20 minute span. So yeah. This is almost like, you can almost imagine Dumbledore with some type of telescope or something staring down from the headmaster's suite at Hagrid's hut, and he's like, okay, it's happening. It's happening.
Here we go.
He's not even going to have to miss exams. This is perfect.
I know. Because the other thing is, like, if you're Quirrell, if you've waited this long, just wait till summer, man. You know, like, you'll be at some point, Dumbledore is going to leave the castle this summer.
Oh, I know. You know? Certainly. Like, if anything, Dumbledore is sort of like landlocked a little bit. Like, I can't leave.
I know, right? I got the students are here. I got to watch the students.
Got to watch out for the students. I know. We're like 1 week out here. That is a super, super good point. I love that.
So there you go.
I think you're dead on the mark, though, because the timing is just spectacular.
Yeah. It is like, yeah, why does it just so happen that they're trying on the day realizes it? Because Dumbledore leaves because they've realized it.
Right. And that's the other thing too, is that it seems like Dumbledore's eventual return, you know, not to hop too far ahead, but it pretty much seems like Dumbledore is able to, because we, eventually Dumbledore does make it into the chamber beneath the school to save Harry, right?
Yes, that is correct. There's also the manner in which he like travels to the ministry, which is like sus.
Like he flies.
You know, like he flies when he could clearly just like flu powder over there or something.
But I mean, we do eventually learn that sometimes Dumbledore will take the Thestrals because he prefers
I guess that's true. Guess that's true.
So I don't know. I mean,
but it's like he could still just like get to the edge, apparate.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I don't know. It is one of those things where it's like as skilled as Dumbledore is, it's like,
or he could just fox out.
He could just fox out. Yeah. Or maybe he needs to like save that. Maybe that's like a one time use thing, and he has to save it for the situation with Umbridge.
Maybe
and Kingsley way forward in the future. There is the little line here that we get where nobody can really believe how Hagrid didn't see the face of the person he got the egg from. And Hagrid says, it's not that unusual. You get a lot of funny folk in the hog's head. And I looked ahead because I was like, gosh, I'm pretty sure Harry recalls this when he eventually goes in there to have like the first meeting of the DA.
Oh yeah.
And it is a word for word recollection that Harry eventually does have. And he's like, I do kind of see how it wasn't weird for Hagrid to be dealing with a cloaked figure. Like it's sort of like a fashion choice for the Hogshead.
It's not even a fashion choice. Hilariously, like not only is the hooded figure there literally specifically trying to like conceal their identity for the sake of getting information, but then when Harry is there with the DA, there are two people with their faces covered, one of whom is Mundungus Fletcher, and one of whom is like reporting to Umbridge.
Like,
all of the people there, like they're hiding their face, like not as a fashion choice. It's because they're there to spy. Three out of three times.
Right. Yes. Everybody is quite literally like trying to pull something all the time.
Yes.
Yeah. Hogshead, famous place for people to be overheard. Let's see.
This was funny. I think they're like, they run inside and they're looking for Dumbledore and they're like looking around and it says, where's Dumbledore's office? And I just wrote down, behind the Gryffindor.
That's the name of the show.
That's the name of the show.
Nailed it. Yeah, I also highlighted something from that exact same thing. It said, they'd never been told where Dumbledore lived, nor do they know anyone who had ever been sent to see him. And I just wrote next to that. That's kind of surprising that like, you know, especially because I think like a principal, you know, in at least an American high school, like surely sees kids who are misbehaving every single day.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like that's, it seems like one of the chief things.
I know.
Chief responsibilities.
It does seem like you should be able to know where the headmaster's office is. Like it says they looked around as if hoping to see a sign pointing them pointing them in the right direction. It's like, yeah, it does seem like there should be a sign though, or something.
It does.
Like,
yeah.
Like you should, this shouldn't be a mystery.
Right.
You know?
No, I know. So then they run into McGonagall, who they're basically... This is like one of those situations where it's like, so often you're like, okay, Golden Trio, why don't you ever ask adults for help? And this is one of those instances where they are correct about their assumptions as to what's going on. They have the wrong person.
They're the wrong person,
but,
yeah.
But at the very least, they are still correct that somebody's going after it and it does need to be protected. And McGonagall basically, you know, she drops her books, which when I was researching this chapter, I discovered is apparently like a McGonagall ism.
Oh, does she?
So apparently, yeah, like on numerous occasions throughout the story, when she hears something shocking, she's holding a large stack of books and will drop them.
Oh my gosh. Do you know what else I discovered was a weird character trait that this character hasn't been introduced yet, but Cornelius Fudge bounces on his feet a lot.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It does. Yes.
Yeah. I can like, now that you say that, I'm like, oh, I know that about him. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's like one of those things I haven't really noticed. I was looking, I forget what I was trying to look up the other day, but I was like, oh, Luke asked me if there was a spell that made people like go the wrong direction or something. And I was like, I think there is. Isn't there like a spell that like makes people like shoot off in the wrong direction or something? And I was trying to look up like what word would like indicate that the spell had been used. And I was like, ooh, maybe bouncing off the walls or something.
Right.
And what I just came up with was Fudge was bouncing on his feet. Fudge was bouncing on the balls of his feet. Fudge was bouncing on the balls of his feet. I was like, oh, okay.
Well, how about that?
Well, what do you know?
Fudge is sure.
He's a little bouncer.
Yeah. Little ball bouncer.
Bouncy Fudge.
Yeah. There you go. But so then let's see here. What else do we have?
she tells him that Dumbledore left.
Yes, 10
minutes
exactly
ago. And then she's like, "How do you know about the stone?" And which I just highlighted. I was like, "Well, the centaurs know. How do they know about it?" You know, which I was going to use to bring up how we talked about the centaurs, but we already sort of talked about them. So we'll just move right past that.
Got them covered. Yep. Let's see here.
Oh, she says Professor Dumbledore will be back tomorrow, which is like, again, the magical travel seems like weirdly slow.
Right. Yeah. It does. It does kind of seem like one of those things. But this, I mean, given everything we just said, it almost certainly to me seems like Dumbledore basically just goes to like Hogsmeade.
Yeah.
And he's probably just like sitting there with Aberforth, just like waiting.
He's like, "Guess what? Tonight's the night, bro."
So, Aberforth is probably, you showed him the mirror, didn't you? And he's like, "Yeah, I showed him the mirror. Gave him the invisibility cloak. He was there that night."
Yeah.
How about
this? This kid is amazing.
Works like a charm. Just like Hagrid. Does exactly what I expect
exactly him to do. Exactly what I think he's going to do.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
One of the things during the exchange with McGonagall that I thought was kind of telling for, again, McGonagall, was they're going back and forth and basically, like, you know, expressing their concern about the stone. And, McGonagall runs into them, I think, standing in front of the door, and she says, "I suppose you think you're harder to get past than a pack of enchantments," which was sort of like very much just announcing that there's a pack of enchantments guarding.
Oh, yes. She like lets spill some information.
Yes.
I wrote that too. I like underlined that. I was like, oop, oddly informative on that front. And then at the very next page, like they set up like a, you know, a sting operation to try and make sure that they're like watching Snape to keep an eye on him. Or keep an eye on the teacher's office or whatever. And like Hermione's going to pretend to need a book from Flitwick or something. But it says, "Snape came out and asked me what I was doing. So I said I was waiting for Flitwick. And Snape went to go get him." And I was like, "That's oddly helpful for Snape."
Right,
like,
yes.
He just went and got him? Like, right. Oh, okay, yeah, hold on.
This is
you
an
need
instance,
a favor?
Right, this is an instance where you almost want to be like an onlooker where Snape comes back having collected Flitwick and is sort of like, "Hermione?"
And he's like, "Where'd you go?" "I do one nice thing. Oh, yeah."
This was it. This was the moment. I was going to help Granger.
Actually, there's a scene where he like runs into them outside, which I love the scene in the movie. But he says, "Be warned, Potter." Well, this is when he's like, "People might think you're up to something," or whatever. But he just calls after them with the book and says, "Be warned, Potter. Any more nighttime wanderings, and I will personally make sure you are expelled. Good day to you." Which, to me, it's like, he's like threatening him. But I'm like, is he actually trying to keep them safe? Like, I think, like, to me, like, reading it through the like the lens of Snape is trying to help Harry, is like, he knows Dumbledore is gone, and he knows that means this is the night. Like, Snape also knows Quirrell might try tonight, so it's like, seriously, don't get out of bed tonight, okay? Seriously,
tonight is not the night.
Not the night.
You should not do this.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're gonna be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like, they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like, they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair
infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. Y'all, I've got to say, I love international travel. I don't know if there's anything that opens your eyes and mind more to different walks of life than immersing yourself inside of new ones. But one hesitation I always have about going somewhere new is how to best navigate the differing languages. But that's where Rosetta Stone can help. Because for me, it's not just about like the fear of getting lost, although to be fair, it's not a concern either. But to me, the immersion goes so much further than simply being somewhere else. I want to engage with and respect the locale by communicating in their tongue, not my own. And that's what's so great about Rosetta Stone. They provide 25 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, and more. And they use such an intuitive approach designed for you to pick up the language naturally, so you're really learning to speak, listen, and the one I always find the most fascinating, think in a new language. And what's even better is that when you sign up, it's for life. Yeah, a lifetime membership, because let's face it, we can only travel to so many new places, but so fast. But with all the time in the world, you can be ready for any adventures ahead. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Through the Gryffindor listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off your unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah.
We do get Harry's big argument as to pretty much why he's going to go after it. And it's one of those things that I think really sets up Harry for like just the kind of person that he is, mm-hmm. and why he is so uniquely capable in his battle against Voldemort. But it says, if I get caught before I can get to the stone, well, I'll have to go back to the Dursleys and wait for Voldemort to find me there. It's only dying a bit later than I would have, because I'm never going over to the dark side. And this is like one of those things where it's sort of like Harry has not even known for one full year the full story. He has not known that he's a wizard.
Right.
And like, you know, he has dealt with some really dangerous blows and like has only even just recently been able to like sort of like even shoulder some of the mantle of responsibility associated with what he's going to ultimately have to be up against.
Mm-hmm.
And as an 11-year-old, he is basically declaring like, I am never turning over. Like I will die right. before yeah. that happens. And it's just like, man, Harry, like if I go back to 11-year-old me, I'm shaking in my boots.
Oh, I know. Like, absolutely.
No way in the world.
Yeah. True Gryffindor for sure. Yeah. So I had highlighted that passage as well, because it's just sort of like a fun little factoid here where he says, I'll have to go back to the Dursleys and wait for Voldemort to find me there, which just like fun fact, he'd have to wait like 6 years.
He would have to wait 6 years. It would yeah. be really disappointing for Harry.
He's just Voldemort there. Sucks at finding people.
Right. Could you just imagine sitting in wait for 6 full years being like, I really thought he was going to come like on day one, like, and yeah. now we're like 4.5 years into this, and I'm yes. just bored.
Yeah, this is in reference to the Bond of Blood charm that Dumbledore is able to put on Harry, which the Bond of Blood charm is one of the most bonkers spells in all of Harry Potter.
It is very confusing and extremely yeah. convoluted, and it feels like one of those things that's just sort of like, I don't know if this could work in any other situation, but you almost just need like a reason to answer the question, why doesn't Dumbledore just attack him while he's at the Dursleys?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, because he can't. Yeah,
yeah, that's the reason. So, hilariously, had Harry returned to the Dursleys and stayed in the house, Voldemort could not have found him for another 6 years until he turned 17, which is another part of the spell. Harry also predicts that if Voldemort comes back, there won't be a Hogwarts to be expelled from. He'll flatten it or turn it into a school for the dark arts, which is exactly what happens in year 7.
That is exactly right.
So, yeah, I was like, ooh, that's a nice little prediction there.
Right.
I love when after that sentiment that Harry says, the part you just read, Hermione just responds, you're right, Harry. And it's just like, oh, like she recognizes it like right away.
I know. Yeah. There's the moment there, like Like where they're talking about the invisibility cloak, and Ron basically chimes in and says, but will it cover all three of us? All three of us? Oh, come off it. You don't think we let you go alone? And that it's like one of those things where it's like, I mean, everybody would love to think that they would have friends that would basically be like, yeah, mm-hmm. like we're with you. Like,
yeah.
you know, cause I mean, similarly, like, I mean, again, these people have only known each other for, you know, 10 months.
Oh yeah.
It's like, I mean, this is not a huge span of time to put your life on the line over, and oh, they do, and they are willing to do it.
And this also, I love this scene in particular because it parallels exactly what happens before the Horcrux hunt too.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Yes, I'm fine.
Yeah, a little, I mean, it's, no, I know. It's just you're exactly right though, because I mean, eventually Harry basically is so, this is the end of Half-Blood Prince. He's like, you know, Dumbledore's gone and he mm-hmm. knows he's going to have to go on this battle alone. And he's just sort of like, I'm not coming back to school next year. I've broken up with Ginny. And yeah, it's the, you know, Ron and Hermione are like, we decided forever ago, we're coming with you. And that's that. No talking us out of it. So yeah. I mean, once again, I mean, just like the ironclad friendship that is involved here is so amazing.
Yep. Also, then this is just like a little funny thing, like a sentence later where they're talking about getting thrown out and like Hermione's like, Flitwick told me in secret I got 112% on his exam. They're not throwing me out after that. I was like, okay.
I said, this isn't the best argument.
Well, justify it however you need, Hermione.
I absolutely love it when we both have identified the same passages or wrote notes about it. It's like, okay, that's so funny. That stood out to both of us.
Yes. Oh, I also like when Harry runs up to get the cloak. It says he pockets the flute to use on Fluffy. He didn't feel much like singing, and like that would have been hilarious.
And I literally wrote hilarious to imagine this being essential.
Know, we have to sing.
What song would they sing?
But honestly, it would have tied in nicely because it would have been just like at the beginning when Dumbledore was like, magic beyond what we do here.
Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Even that's a Dumbledore big plan thing.
Yeah, I know.
It's he's like literally
music.
You're going to be looking for one important detail for most of the year. The answer to the question you're looking for is music.
Music. It is not a magical answer. It is a musical answer. There we go.
There it is again.
I love how they stay up until midnight or whenever they're waiting to go down there. And the thing is just the three of them in the common room. And even after Harry goes up back to his dorm to get the invisibility cloak and the flute, he doesn't notice that Neville's there, and like they have just failed to notice Neville in the common room the whole time.
The whole night, Neville's literally just sitting there with his frog.
I know, he's like, with the frog.
Yeah.
Don't notice me. Ninja Neville down there.
Yep, I love it.
Fantastic. Neville really being a real Gryffindor, though. He says, you'll be caught again. Gryffindor will be even more trouble. And I was like, oh, look at Neville.
I know.
Proving it to himself.
I mean, and the fact that he's even putting like House Gryffindor above everything else, you know, is like, it's just such a testament to the eventual true Gryffindor that Neville actually is. This is another one of those moments where it'd be curious to know how much of this exact scene is explained to any of the professors, because Dumbledore also knows that this happens and awards Neville points for it.
Exactly. I guess someone finds him there.
Somebody could have found Neville. I mean, there's a question as to how long the Petrificus Totalis, there's a question as to how long that spell would last after Hermione left, or if he would ever be able to stand up. I will say that if you've never and I don't recommend it, but I remember in middle school, I used to go and hang out with my friends in the neighborhood in the middle of the night. We would like walk around our neighborhood and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there was this like one night where we were like, hey, can anybody just stand straight up and fall backwards? Like just fall flat on your back without like, it's kind of like doing a belly flop, but just on land. And it's just painful for no reason. And I remember doing it and everybody was like, whoa, that was so impressive. And I was like, I can't breathe.
Yeah. Knocks the wind out of me.
But I was like, gosh, falling with no ability to stop yourself on your face. I mean, that's a broken nose. Absolutely. Yeah.
I do remember there was one point in college where me and our buddy John were walking back to his apartment, and it had snowed the night before, and I don't know what we were doing, but he was just like, John Carlin, I'll give you $1 if you fall on your face in the snow right now. And like less than half a second later, I was just like, okay. I fell straight on my face in the snow, and I think he was so shocked by the speed in which I like accomplished the task.
Yes, I'm in.
I'm in. Boom. Okay, give me a dollar.
Did you get a dollar?
I did. He did. He was like, "Here you go."
That's okay, amazing.
Here's a dollar.
That's amazing.
Well, I think about that. I'm like, what if there'd been something under the snow?
Oh, I know. Gosh, can you imagine like a little manhole cover or something?
Oh yeah.
So bad.
That would have been the worst.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. But there wasn't. I'm fine.
There we go. So then we move on to pairs nicely with one of the questions that we got at the end of last week's episode. So they're basically like traveling through, the corridors on their way to get to Fluffy and through the trap door, and they stumble across Peeves.
Yep.
And the quick thinking on the feet situation here, and this is like, it's kind of interesting because there's a couple different ways to like write this passage, in my personal opinion, where it's like, again, this is already like the second longest chapter in the book. It's not like we're lacking for details or anything. You could just have them not run into Peeves. And I don't think anybody would have been like, "Hey, wait a second. How would they get through the corridor so easily?" It's like
they're already under the invisibility cloak.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they've already got Norbert to the top of the astronomy tower. Of course, they don't remember how they did that either, but, but they did that without running into anybody. So it's like, this is one of those where it's like, what happens is they run into Peeves, and quick on his feet, Harry basically decides to impersonate the Bloody Baron.
Yeah.
And says, "Peeves, the Bloody Baron has his own reasons for being invisible." And Peeves basically just like rolls over.
Yeah.
Like, "So sorry, your bloodiness, Mr. Baron, sir." And, you know, like goes through this whole thing.
That's your Peeves voice?
Yeah, I don't know why I went with that. I felt like, it felt so wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's what I did. So now we're stuck with that forever. Live on the internet. But why does this work so well? Like, this to me feels ridiculous, but it also, I mean, it's like we started posing the idea that once upon a time, like Fred and George are like the only people who Peeves ever takes like orders from
when
when they're leaving in Order of the Phoenix to go and start Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like in opposition to Umbridge, who is basically the like antithesis to everything that Peeves represents. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is all order and, you know, no chaos. And that is, you know, like Peeves' MO is
right.
Order or, you know, lack of order and chaos.
Yeah.
And so it's like one of these things where it's like, I almost have to believe that as menacing as the Bloody Baron is supposed to be as like a character, I have to think that he was like a goofball. Like the creation point for Peeves himself.
I mean,
like,
it could be. I've always just interpreted it as him being like really afraid of the Baron because he's like covered in blood. But yeah, I don't know.
That seems,
it seems
like,
weird.
I mean, I don't disagree with you. I mean, that's like, I mean, that to me, I feel like is the base explanation.
Right.
I feel like I want a better explanation.
Yeah, I do want a better explanation. Yeah. They don't. This isn't fleshed out. I think the reason this obstacle shows up in here, because you're right, you could just have him just not run into Peeves at all. And it's not like, "Hey, wait, blah, blah, hey." I think from like a writing standpoint, the reason this is in here is because like you have all of like Dumbledore's pre-lined up obstacles for them to overcome.
Right.
But then this is like another way that Harry demonstrates. It's a way to show that Harry can think on his feet even for things that Dumbledore didn't even plan for him to have to get over.
And I
don't think Dumbledore set Peeves up there. It's like Peeves is just in the castle, and it's like this is really the first obstacle, and it's like the unplanned one, and Harry just skates past it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's you know the unplanned task.
Asking out Cho.
Yeah. This is exactly what I was going to say. I mean, obviously that's a very like superficial version of this exact thing showing up, but we do obviously in Goblet of Fire have the first, second, and third task. And then there's the unexpected task, which is asking somebody out on a date. So I suppose there is something to be said for things like that, that like Harry will inevitably have to face. But I also feel like, so then immediately after that, we basically find ourselves, going into the room where they find the harp that is playing by itself, and Fluffy is asleep, and they're essentially like getting ready to like find their way into the trap door, where they jump down and
Hold on.
Okay, sorry.
Before they do that, they're underneath the cloak. Harry turns the other door and says, "If you want to go back, I won't blame you." He said, "You can take the cloak. I won't need it now." I just was like, you have no way of knowing that. like at all. What are you talking about? You're still planning to sneak up on Snape, a fully qualified wizard. Don't you think an invisibility cloak would be useful?
It could be. Yeah. I don't know. That was like one of those where I could sort of see a world where it's just sort of like, well, once I'm down there, like then I'm in it, you know, like it's just going to be what it is. Mm-hmm. But no, what I was going to say was, so then they find the trapdoor. They jump into the trapdoor. They fall and fall and fall. It says down, down, down and flump, which I did write down. I think it's like the perfect sound for this particular occasion, like a flump sound.
I wrote excellent use of the word flump.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Once again, we're on the same page. That is so funny. So then he looks up and the light through the trapdoor is the size of a postage stamp, which is impossibly small.
Well, Ben, I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay.
Because once upon a time, many videos ago on the Bane Super Carlin Brothers channel, I think we have a video called Does Sorcerer's Stone Predict Everything?
Okay.
And in that, we did some math and we figured out there's like a formula you can figure out to see like to figure out the perspective of something. Like if something what looked to be the size of a postage stamp, if you knew the actual measurements of it, you could know how far away you'd have to be for it to look that small.
Okay.
Okay. So in the video, we assumed that the trapdoor itself was 2 meters across, so about like 6 feet or so.
Okay.
And in order for it to look like a postage stamp, you would have to be about 275 feet away from the trapdoor for it to look like the size of a postage stamp.
Okay.
Which means that's like 270 feet. That's like 27 stories or something, right?
Sure. Yeah.
which is a long, long way. Which means they would have also been falling for about 4 to 5 seconds, which if you've ever been falling through space for more than a second, that's a really long time to be falling.
It does feel like forever. Yes. We have done a fair bit of like our own, like sort of like kind of air quotes cliff jumping, where we jump off rocks into water. And there is this sort of like odd feeling where you like have left the solid surface that you were sitting on, you know, the rock or whatever. And then you were just sort of like in nothing, you know, you're just falling through the air. Actually, similarly, I also did a bungee jump once upon a time where I fell, I don't know, for like 6 straight seconds or something.
Oh my gosh.
Super
far.
Absolutely terrifying. The thing that I followed it up with, as far as we're looking at math, is that then Hermione and Ron join Harry down there where Hermione says we must be miles under the school. And so I did the quick math on that. It takes about 20 seconds to fall 1 mile.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So in the event that, obviously like it seems like the hole would be much, much, much smaller than a postage stamp at that point.
Yeah. Or else the trapdoor is massive. Yeah. But at that point, I don't know. I guess it could be if Fluffy's standing on it, but it doesn't seem like there's any reason for it to be that big.
Right.
But certainly like in the movie, it's not, even when I was doing this, I was like six feet seems like pretty generous.
It does. Yeah. I mean, that seems like a pretty big trap door considering it, you know, just doesn't need to be that big. But so even miles plural would suggest that they fell for at least 40 seconds.
Oh, well, here's the other thing. If you were, according to the math we did in that video, if you're falling for 4 to 5 seconds, it means you've achieved a speed of 75 to 80 miles per hour of falling.
Goodness
gracious. These better be some truly flumpy vines they're landing on,
Jake, they're
you know.
The flumpiest.
They are. I mean, yes. We can only assume they're the flumpiest.
Yes,
I mean,
yes indeed.
We got probably they even reached up and like caught them, nestled them down to the ground.
Right.
Before starting to strangle them.
To be fair, we actually literally just made a video a couple of weeks ago as well, not to get too off track here. Because in the movie Frozen, there's a claim that you could jump 200 feet into freshly fallen snow.
Yeah.
And it would be like just like falling on a pillow. And so I was doing some fact checking on that particular occasion and discovered that in World War II, there was a pilot who fell from his plane and his parachute had burned up and fell, I think, 18,000 feet into fresh powder and survived. So, is it possible? Technically possible.
Yeah.
For it to happen.
So there's that.
Doesn't mean it's not absurd, though.
Anyway, Harry, Ron, Hermione fell roughly 27 stories at about 80 miles per hour and landed with a flump.
There we go. Yep. So absolutely. But no, this finally brings me back to the point that I was going to make that you were kind of making about peeves, which is that like They are then being strangled by the devil's snare, which it turns out the flumptacular plant is, in fact. And Harry, amidst the chaos, just yells, "So light a fire," which I think Ron will end up crediting Harry for. I think he says, like, lucky Harry doesn't lose his head in a crisis. There's no wood, honestly.
I know.
Wood. So, I mean, I understand the point you're making about Peeves in the hallway and sort of like, you know, this shows like Harry's resourcefulness, but I also felt like this particular task is also like going to at least some lengths to do the exact same thing.
Oh, absolutely it is. Yeah. This is just one that's set up on purpose.
Right.
Yeah, I gave Harry, Ron, and Hermione all a point for this one because Harry's the one who suggests the fire, and then Ron is the one who reminds her that she's a witch, and then Hermione actually does the spell.
I think you got to give Hermione a little tilt here because she's it's like literally it's like, are you a witch or not? It's like, Ron, are you a wizard or not? Like, you know, like, but to be fair, the Bluebell Flame is something that does seem like a bit of a signature spell of Hermione's, which it like to the tune of, it could be comparable to like, you know, Harry's Patronus or Expelliarmus or something like it. Yeah. Like she may be particularly like adept at this skill.
Oh, for sure. And I've sort of been under the impression that the boys are not capable of like reaching their wands at this moment either.
Maybe not. Yeah. Maybe they've been strangled a little bit more than Hermione, who is the last one to get there. So that's fair. I mean, I think you could probably give each of them, you know, a fair bit of credit for making it past that.
I think there's a fun line at the bottom too, where it says, if they've been a dragon, a fully grown dragon, Norbert had been bad enough. And I just love that. It's like, that is like a little bit of foreshadowing, I think, for Gringotts further on down the line in book 7, where they in fact are in a similar situation where they're deep underground and they're trying to break into something, and now they do run into a fully grown dragon, and what are they going to do?
Right. Yes, that's true.
Yep.
Then they successfully get past it.
Yep.
Okay, so then let's see here. Is it the... Yes, the first room that they encounter is going to be the Winged Keys.
Yep.
This is once again, obviously, like such a apparent charm. This is another one of those things where it's like Harry's prowess as Seeker feels like such obvious inspiration for why this task would be chosen for this particular situation.
Yeah, this one's all Harry. I mean, I guess Ron recognizes what the key is supposed to look like, but this one Harry gets all the points for, I think. This is just sort of as a complete aside for, we sell candles, as you know.
We do.
And inside those candles, after they're melted down, there's like these little collectible charms inside, which is like, you know, really fun. So, some of the like magically inspired candles that we sell, one of the charms you can get is a winged key.
It is.
And we have a bunch of them here at the office, and my kids were here the other day, and Luke has read the first book, and he was like so excited to find the winged key. And then of course, once one of them finds it, they all want one,
of course.
So I had to find three different winged key charms
that we somehow had. Yeah,
that we had here at the office, and they are just like running around the house, like having a blast playing with the winged key charms.
That's amazing. So, I know. That's amazing.
Like, my kids love these.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah,
no, I love that. One of the things I did write down is that in the movie, actually, one of the things that happens is that once you grab the correct key, the other keys then kind of go onto the offensive and sort of attack.
Yeah,
and
they start going like kind of crazy just as soon as you touch the broom.
Yeah, you're right. That's exactly it. So that was actually something that I was like, that actually I think is a good inclusion that they sort of expanded on this idea for the film.
Yeah.
Because I do think it makes it all the more menacing. I mean, hard enough to catch the key in the first place, but then to also have a bunch of, you know, flying bullets for all intents and purposes. I mean, you know, like sharp flying fast flying metal keys. I mean, that's pretty dangerous. It flies you up pretty quickly. So
I also, this is like, whenever I read this one, I'm always like, how did Quirrell do this?
I know. Yeah. Like it actually takes all three of them, and Harry's like a super talented seeker.
Yeah. And they know which one it is because someone's already caught it.
Right.
Like he would have had to have found the key the first time too.
Right. Yep. That's exactly.
You know, so I'm always like, wonder if he just like, you know, summons it or something.
Could be.
Has like a way around it. But I would assume that they would account for that. You know, like the Alohomora doesn't work on the door, so it feels like Osseo wouldn't work on the keys.
It does
like
feel that way.
You have to play the game to beat the game.
Right. It's always one of those things that drives me nuts when they're Horcrux hunting, is that they try the Osseo thing over and over and over, and you're just sort of like, yeah, it doesn't work, y'all.
It's
like, it's not going to be that easy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess you always got to try.
You got to try. You never know.
From there, we make our way into the chess chamber. The
chess chamber!
Which is where Ron obviously gets to really like kind of showcase his abilities. One of the things that I found kind of interesting or curious about this, if you will, is that Wizard's Chess just by itself is kind of already a thing. And this is supposedly McGonagall's obstacle and Transfiguration is her task. And so I was like, what did she transfigure into the pieces?
I know. I guess it's just like making them come alive.
Possibly.
I know.
Because yeah. I guess on the one hand, you don't need like somebody shouting instructions for the opposing side to know what to do.
Yeah.
Like it will just kind of like play on its own, kind of as if you're playing like against the computer.
The computer. Yeah. It says they say it on the next page, just McGonagall transfigured the chessmen to make them alive.
Okay.
So I mean, I guess that's it.
I guess
it's kind of a, no, they got to the top of the tower. They're alive. Transfiguration. McGonagall. Her task. Ron. Yay.
Yay. It works out. There's a couple like little like interesting things about this though, where it feels like almost like there could be other consideration in mind. I mean, the general idea is that they have Harry and Hermione take over a castle and a bishop, which would be two pieces in chess that you'd probably be overall less likely to sacrifice early. So that's like a reasonably good strategy. But you also could have just had Harry take the place of the king, and then it would essentially be like, so long as you don't lose, nothing can happen to Harry.
Right. You could have done that for sure.
Right.
It almost like, as far as like chess goes too, like rooks are more valuable than knights or bishops.
Okay.
So it's kind of surprising Ron doesn't take the rook spot.
Sure.
Since he's going to be like a little bit more of the valuable player here.
Maybe it's like early foreshadowing that he has like a quiet, even he's unaware of crush on Hermione.
Oh,
he's
could
trying
be.
To, trying
yeah.
to like be like, let's put you in the overall safest.
Right. Yeah. And the I think it's fun to have Ron like, I'll be a knight.
A little bit, because I mean, he is going in, he is commanding the army, so to speak. So
yeah.
I think it's kind of cool to have him play as the knight. However, though, one of the questions I always have sort of is like, we know very quickly, like the way that the other pieces take one another, if you will, is by destroying one another.
Yes.
But like, I was wondering, like, you know, as Hermione goes up and I think steals a piece, it's sort of like, what does Hermione do? Go and like sort of like punch this statue?
I know.
Or
I wrote that too. Like, I was like, does she smash them?
Right. Yeah. It's like, yeah. how does this
touch it, like, go around? Please move. I'm taking you now.
Right. I that honestly feels more likely. Yeah. But then as we move to the end of it, basically we see, you know, Ron's big sacrifice, which is super sad. And of course, like in the situation, like they don't know what they're sacrificing. I mean, like, you know, like Ron could die.
Oh, I know. Like this situation. He absolutely could. Like, they, I mean, as far as they've seen, I mean, it's, this is one of those where like the book is worse than the movie.
Yeah.
In terms of like the like in the movie, Ron is riding on top of a horse and the queen stabs the horse and Ron just sort of falls off. Like in the book, the queen just like backhands him across the face,
just,
and
like clubs him,
just clubs him. And it's like, you know, it doesn't mention like a sword, but you know, if in the book the queen had a sword like she does in the movie, like, and she doesn't hit and she just hits Ron. Like, I don't think in the book he's like riding on the piece. He's just standing there.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, like, she just would have chopped him right in half, man.
I know. It feels very dangerous. And the actually, this is always one of those scenes where I would love to know the behind the scenes on it a little bit if you watch the movie, especially like on like a computer where you can kind of like frame by frame it. But when Rupert Grint, the actor who plays Ron, falls on the ground, there's a piece of rubble that sort of like skates across and like cuts his face. And it's either like a really good piece of editing, which is entirely possible, or Rupert Grint actually has his face cut in this scene, because it's almost like you can see like the rubble like sort of like scatter across him or whatever, and you can see like his cheek like move, and then there is like, you know, blood visible afterwards. And it's like you couldn't have frozen the scene in the moment and gone back and like painted in the blood or anything. So it would have had to have been done in post. But I've always wondered, like, is it possible he like actually cuts his face in that scene?
Oh, that'd be very interesting to know.
Yeah.
Anyway, get hurt.
Yeah, did he get hurt? But then as we move to the final piece there, we do know that Harry is playing bishop. And this is like one of those things where it's like, it's kind of hard to know if it's an error or just sort of like a poor way of describing how a bishop moves. But Ron has gone down, and the last move that has to be done for checkmate is Harry moved 3 spaces to the left.
Yeah.
I mean, left diagonally is fine for me. Like, I don't think this is like a massive error or anything, but at the very least, if I was standing on a checkerboard and somebody said to move three spaces to the left, I would move like orthogonally. What is that word? I only know it from like playing board games.
Oh, you mean like left, just left or right?
Like left, right, north, south, basically.
Like cardinally, like yeah. Cardinal directions.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, when you read that, no part of you is sort of like left on thinking that Harry is the bishop is not moving diagonally.
Well, early on the page before he does, like when Harry, his first command to Harry is Harry, move diagonally four squares to the right.
Okay.
So he does preface it before. Maybe he just stops staying diagonally.
Maybe so.
Or
maybe
whatever. So. And like, we know Harry knows how to play chess, so it's like, it'd be an illegal move for him to do it otherwise. But
yeah. What happens if you do it illegal? What happens if you don't know the rules?
Yeah, right. Are you like just stuck in those little squares?
Right.
Yeah. I think the next room they get to is the troll room, which they're able to just walk right through. But this, if you're like, not that you need to like think about it for very long because you're about to figure out the secret anyway, but this could be like, this is your last chance to like connect the dots that it's Quirrell and not Snape.
Oh, sure.
Because like they say like only two left, Quirrell and Snape. And it's like, you know, like once you go into this room, I guess you could think the troll was either Quirrell or Snape. So once you get to the potions, you'll know that the troll was Quirrell's room. So you'll know that Quirrell is associated with trolls, which could then lead you to the, like, you could deduce out that he's the one who let the troll in the first time.
Yeah, so this again kind of goes back to that thought where, like, if you were watching this episodically on, like, you know, like, week by week, chapter by chapter in like TV series form. And again, I would propose this as like 100 years in the future to the point where it's like, it's been long enough to where it, like the plot of this story isn't maybe everyday common knowledge necessarily. Right. I could see a world where you get to episode 16 of this series and people could start realistically, you could just read the books and know the answer to it. But I could see people theorizing and being able to work backwards by the end of this chapter and sort of sort out that you might think it's Quirrell,
right,
instead of Snape. Like, yeah. I think you're right. Like, I think that there could be enough information left on the table for people to like suss it out,
right?
Especially if theorizing is still a thing 100 years from now.
Oh, for sure,
which almost certainly it will be.
People are just going to watch the TV and not read the books. You know, way too lazy for that.
Right.
Yeah.
The one thing I have always found to be kind of interesting is that obviously Quirrell has gone through before them, and all of the other tasks have been reset in some capacity. So they're all like back.
Oh, I know.
They're back to normal. So the fact that the troll is actively still stunned, I always do find to be kind of interesting. I mean, obviously, like it's not a video game. It's not like it's meant to be restored for each person. I guess the winged key has kind of got
even the devil snare. It's like, you know, certainly Quirrell must have burned it as well, or done something to get through it, and it seems like it's recovered just fine. Whatever he did do it,
exactly. Yeah. So it's I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I find it surprising or problematic or anything for that matter. I guess it's just sort of like, huh.
Surprising thing to me is that on the next room, the potion that lets you walk through the black fire is like one gulp, and that has refilled itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is another one of those, like, why would it refill itself? Like,
or even if you're Quirrell, I mean, you could go through the next room and just start changing the position of the potions around. Like,
yeah,
you know, that way, like, if anybody's following me, like, they're going to get the wrong answer.
They're going to get the wrong answer. That's true. Boy, that would have been sneaky. So, yeah, let's talk about the potions because that's the next part.
Yep.
This is the logic puzzle that Hermione figures out. I always, 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 whenever I get here, I so badly wish there was, like a diagram, like a picture that went with the riddle.
Oh, that would be
nice.
So that
you could,
like,
try and figure it out. I'm like... I'm sure people have done this online and just been like, and like drawn it in such a way, like, so that it makes sense or like, but I think it'd be so fun to try and solve yourself. Cause I love little puzzles like this.
No, I know. It is really cool. And I think I was doing like a little bit of research about the riddle itself. And I think what the underlying sentiment for people who have kind of like done like a deep dive on how the riddle all plays out is that you need to know specifically which of the potions is the largest and the smallest, I think, specifically in order to solve it.
Right.
So without a diagram provided by the book, the words alone do not provide you enough context for you to solve it.
Okay.
I think is what it comes down to.
Okay. Well, that is a bummer.
I know. It is a little bit of a bummer. So I agree with you. I absolutely think like for future reprints, if anybody's ever listening, something that would be super cool would be to give us a little picture of a bunch of, in the same way that like sometimes when you get like a letter from Hagrid, it'll be signed by Hagrid, or if it's signed by McGonagall, it's signed
just
by
like
McGonagall.
Put a little drawing of the potion bottles in a row.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Yep. I think that would be a great thing. Like that's not like a picture book. That's just providing a way for the reader to interact with the story.
But there are illustrated versions of this book. I just read this and I don't think there was
an illustration of the potions.
Well, you know, I thought I was reading in the Mina Lima version, not the illustrated edition. So maybe in that one there is.
Maybe
I don't know.
There. Okay.
Report back. But it feels so obvious to me to do that because it'd be so fun to work out.
Yes. And I love this one for Hermione too, because I mean, this is like totally in her wheelhouse. There is a line though that we get from Hermione that I think is pretty great. She says, "This isn't magic. It's logic, a puzzle. A lot of the greatest wizards haven't gotten ounce of logic. They'd be stuck in here forever." And this is like one of those things where I think, you know, again, for like an 11-year-old Hermione to have realized this kind of sentiment, I have found this to be true in the world. Like I often find people who are remarkably intelligent.
Yeah.
But like high intelligence, high computing power of your brain doesn't always translate to someone who then makes like logical decisions.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that like being able to merge like logic with intelligence is what breeds wisdom, which I think is ultimately like what most people are going for. Mm-hmm. But computing power is like the speed of your brain. And the speed of your brain is only as useful as the attached wisdom that you can then place behind it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the entire show. If you've ever watched Big Bang Theory, this is like where
Penny meets Sheldon,
where it's like Sheldon has nothing but logic, but he can't do anything. And Penny is like completely street smart, but she has no logic, and like the two are constantly outsmarting each other in ways you could not possibly expect.
Yes. Yeah.
And,
yeah, yeah.
And then it's like, yeah, then, but it's like the more they become friends, it's like the better everyone is because they can like join their powers or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Nope. That's a really good one. So anyway, then we have the final dialogue. This is another one of those. I often earmark it. I'm sure I'm going to out myself now as Team Hermione. But the little exchange, I think, with Harry and Hermione, and the fact that it comes down to them is always like one of these early nods that I felt like it could have been them.
It could have been them.
I don't die on this hill, for what it's worth. It's
not,
I'm not like that, like hardcore of, you know, like whatever. But there, you know, it does seem like a really good exchange between Harry and Hermione. We get a really great moment that I think basically answers the entire question, which is why isn't Hermione in Ravenclaw? But basically, Hermione says, "Harry, you're a great wizard, you know." And Harry says, "I'm not as good as you." "Me," said Hermione, "books and cleverness. There are more important things, friendship and bravery." And this is exactly like Neville as well. It's like Neville values bravery. And that's why he's like the ultimate Gryffindor. Mm-hmm. And I think in this particular situation, Hermione herself is basically like books, cleverness. Like, yeah, those are fine. But like,
I'm good at them. Clearly.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. 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 A little like shoulder shrug there. But yeah, I think the emphasis on friendship and bravery are what mark her as a true blue Gryffindor.
I also feel like this line in particular is like supposed to telegraph to you, the reader, that like what actually makes a good wizard isn't being good at magic. It's being good at friendship and bravery. Like,
yeah.
These are qualities of a good wizard, not how well you can like cast a spell or something,
right? Like your technical abilities,
which even like it even speaks to like the tasks they're doing, because like one of the things that like Harry's really going to need to defeat Voldemort is like his friends, and like that's what all of these tasks really are. It's like you will have to rely on each other to do them.
Yes. And you know, I think like I mean again, you know, with Dumbledore's big plan, you sort of like can fast forward basically to one of the last conversation, not the last conversation that Dumbledore ever really has with Harry in King's Cross Station, where he like specifically says like, "I counted on Miss Granger to slow you down so that you're." What does he say? So that your hot head didn't outpace your good heart.
Yeah.
I think is what it comes down to. But like even that, I think suggests to me that even this early on, Dumbledore is recognizing the friendships that Harry has forged so early and has included obviously his closest friends as elements in what Harry will need in order to ultimately overcome Voldemort. Like, you know, like the things are set up with Ron's strength in place, with Hermione's strength in place. Like they like account for the people that Harry will keep with him all the way to the end.
Right.
And he does.
Yeah, he totally does. Totally does.
So anyway, then we basically, we see Harry take the potion, which feels like ice. He's able to walk through the flames. And we end with the cliffhanger that says, There was already someone there, but it wasn't Snape. It wasn't even Voldemort.
Yep. Very, very good cliffhanger. I highlighted that sentence in particular. I was like, I'm not sure there's been a sentence in any book that has impacted my entire life like more.
More than that one right there. Yeah. Like you think that's like, this is the moment the book got you.
Right.
Yeah. That's insane. And I mean, it really is, because like, I think as we kind of go, I mean, you could even turn one page and see who it is. I mean, you can see it in the chapter art, but like, this is sort of the moment. Like, you know, I feel like one of the things that I've learned that I never pick up on so much as I've been reading through the books historically is like the number of little notes that I've been able to write down and be like, I don't know about this, or like, that's a reach, or like that can't be right. You know, like whatever. Like it's not like there's not like flaws inside the story, but like when you're reading it in like one big continuous flow, it's easy to be, it's easy to just allow these things to like sort of.
Oh yeah. Like, you know, this is like the way we're reading it is not how you read books, you know?
Precisely.
Yeah. We're like, I mean, we've read these books like, you know, 50, 100 times or whatever. And it's like, you know, now I can go through and like write a little note about this and I will notice every little thing that like doesn't add up and stuff. But like when you're reading it the first time, you don't notice any of that stuff.
No, of course.
And that's not how you read any book the first time.
No. And I don't get stuck on these details to this day. Like, I mean, I don't ever like think back on, you know, like even one of the things I wrote or I highlighted in the page prior is, you know, Harry and Hermione are talking to each other. Harry basically says, go back to the last room, get Ron, take the brooms from the flying key room, get to the trap door, pass Fluffy, go to the Owlery, send Hedwig to Dumbledore, let him know we need him. And Harry says, I might be able to hold Snape off for a while. Yeah, and it's like one of those things where it's like Harry, no, you cannot.
You cannot like, even. Maybe if you had the cloak, you know.
possibly. but like, you know, it's, I mean, there's a million little things that are, you know, the postage stamp, the miles under the school. I mean, you could pick any number of things and you could critique it to no end.
Right.
But when you're a kid and you're reading this story, or when you're an adult and you're reading this story, you know, it's like, this is the moment where the magic trick itself of the story is being delivered to you.
Right. Like the this is the twist.
Yes.
This is it.
And that's the thing. I mean, that all magic is sort of like it's look over here so that you don't see what's happening over here.
Right. That is sort of like the fun of like a book about magic is like it has a magic trick itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And this is the flourish.
This is it.
Moment. Yeah.
Boom.
So I think with that we can pretty much close off chapter 16 and point our sails towards the last and final chapter of our first book here in our podcast read through, chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces.
Oh yeah, very exciting. So much happens in the last chapter. I cannot believe it sometimes. I'm like, we still gotta fight Quirrell. We still gotta have a conversation with Dumbledore. We gotta talk to Ron and Ron and Hermione, and then we gotta you know, award the house cup, and we gotta, it's like, you gotta get back on the train and get back to London. Like, so all of that's gonna happen in one chapter.
Yes. Yeah. So literally, yep. I mean, that's what's shocking about it. So, I mean, not to get too much away about chapter 17, but, you're walking in, you're miles apparently under the school. You're about to face the Mirror of Erised, do all these types of things. And then the last page of the chapter will involve Uncle Vernon.
I know, right? Like, you know, Uncle Vernon is in the same chapter as Voldemort.
Yeah. You
know?
It's like, what?
What?
How is that even possible? One of the most like remarkable, you know, like packing in and like action into a chapter ever. So
yeah,
it's going to be so much fun to dissect that one
as we get to the big finale next week.
Yes, we're almost there. Woo. So do you have a review for us to close out?
Absolutely. I do. This is, let me make sure I get the right person. It's from Carter.
Okay.
It says, everything the Super Carlin brothers do is great. They're both very knowledgeable. I've been reading a long time and listening to the podcast. It has been such a joy. Question. Snape was keeping strict eyes on Quirrell, threatening him and just being mean to him. So why does Voldemort still trust Snape while living in the back of Quirrell's head? And I picked this one out because one, we're obviously like, this is the chapter with Quirrell or, you know, we're getting right up there.
Yeah.
But this answer is actually right in the books in Half-Blood Prince.
Yes.
When Bellatrix and Narcissa come to visit Snape. And Bellatrix, for the sake of the audience, asks Snape all of the questions that you've forgotten to ask or that you haven't been keeping track of, but boy, sure she has. And one of them is, why didn't you help Voldemort get the Sorcerer's Stone? And Snape just answers her straight up, and he says, I think you next wanted to know why I stood between the Dark Lord and the Sorcerer's Stone. That is easily answered. He did not know whether he could trust me. He thought, like you, that I had turned from faithful Death Eater to Dumbledore's stooge. He was in a pitiable condition, very weak, sharing the body of a mediocre wizard. He did not dare reveal himself to a former ally, if that ally might turn him over to Dumbledore or the Ministry. I deeply regret that he did not trust me. He would have returned to power 3 years sooner. As it was, I saw only greedy and unworthy Quirrell trying to steal the stone, and I admit I did all I could to thwart him. And then he goes on to say, the Dark Lord's initial displeasure at my lateness vanished entirely. I assure you, when I explained that I remained faithful, although Dumbledore thought I was his man, yes, the Dark Lord thought I had left him forever, but he was wrong. So that's basically the answer.
Yes. So this is like the, what is it? What does Snape ultimately become? Is he a triple agent?
Is it? Yeah.
Is that how it works? So a double agent would be playing both sides, but like I guess he is just playing both sides. Maybe it is just double agent because he's sort of like both. But this is a situation where it's like he was on the dark side, came to the light side, and is now telling the dark side that he convinced the light side that he was able to.
I think it is triple.
It is triple.
Because if you were just like a secret agent, you'd just be like on the other side pretending to work for them.
Right. True.
Right. And so a double agent is like he's on the dark side. A double agent would be someone who goes to the other side and actually starts working for them against your original enemy.
Yes. Okay.
Right. So he starts on the dark side, goes to the good side, then goes back to the dark side and...
But is operating on behalf of the good side.
Yes. So yeah, I think it is triple agent.
Triple agent. Okay. Yeah. So pretty highly complex, but I also feel like it's a pretty elegant response as well. Like, I mean, for all intents and purposes, I mean, when it comes down to it, Voldemort never reveals to Snape, which he could have. And I mean, that would have made things a lot more complicated. I mean, that's maybe not even the worst what if. Like, what if Voldemort had revealed himself to Snape in book one?
Oh, man, that is a good question. I have to think about it a bunch. Would he immediately... I don't think Snape would... Oh, yeah.
Something to chew on over the weekend.
Something to chew on for sure. Yeah, we'll have to think about that one.
There we go.
It's a good one.
But as ever, guys, if you have a review for the podcast, be sure to let us know, and maybe you'll get to hear it here on the show.
I know. If you have a question for us or anything like that, we will try to get to it. Otherwise, join us next week for the finale of book one, chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces, here through the Gryffindor.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger. For the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.